spring 1990. I'm not sure of the date, but it was either early March or early April, and I re-recorded it on April 28th, 1990. Colloquium given by David Smith about Old Man Plecker, given at Charlottesville, Virginia, for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. I'm re-recording this from tapes made by Oliver Perry.
Parking, we were sort of waiting a minute since people are wandering around trying to find their way into this place. My name is Robert Vaughn. I'd like to welcome you here on behalf of the staff and board of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and of the Center for the Humanities. We have in the audience some current and some former fellows at the center. The center runs a fellowship program that gives awards in a competition to people who are doing work largely related to the history, the culture, the literature of Virginia, but also to Virginians who are interested in other fields and subjects of the humanities. They spend a period of residency here, usually 2 months in the summer or a semester during the year, but we offer shorter awards as well. The work today has been related to a long initiative of the Virginia Foundations. Over the decade of the 80s, we have been involved in what we've called projects that tell the stories or the untold stories of Virginia history. We have had major work done on the history and culture of Virginia women, on the black experience in Virginia from 1619 forward. And now, most recently, we have been involved in trying to tell the story of Virginia's Indian peoples from pre-Jamestown, the people who settled here long before the Europeans arrived. David Smith, the speaker today, has twice been a fellow at the Center for the Humanities. His previous work was on the sterilization of Carrie Buck, another infamous chapter in Virginia history that dates from about the same period as the story we will hear today. David is a professor of education and human development at Lynchburg College, but his work really has been more historical and humanistic than it has been involved with human development. He grew up in Roanoke, attended Virginia Commonwealth University before he went off to Columbia University in New York City, where he got his doctorate. And before he became a college professor, he was a Peace Corps volunteer and a teacher, among other things. He has published, besides the work of on the sterilization of Carrie Buck, a book that came out in 1989 to very wide acclaim, a feature article in the Richmond Times-Dispatch last summer that gave it high praise and recommended it widely. Another on psychological profiles of conjoined twins, heredity, environment, and identity. And a third, Minds Made Feeble, which won an honorable mention in the Book of the Year Awards for 1985. Many articles, many board memberships, directors of schools, of camps, president of the board of directors of Virginia Special Olympics, for example, among them, and a frequent consultant. His work now is on Walter Plecker and the Racial Integrity Act of 1924. It is without a doubt one of the saddest and most miserable stories in Virginia history. He is interested in telling this painful and very delicate story in a way that will be objective and that will restore to Virginia history a sense of the peoples that it tend to deprive of their history at the time. We have in the audience today a number of people who've been interested in this work. We have a number of people who are Virginia Indian peoples. And we hope that you will all feel free to comment, to criticize, to question David, to challenge him, so that we can help him to get this story right and to be able to tell it well. So we welcome you here today, and all of you as well. Thank you. It's a privilege to be here with you today. I feel really honored at the turnout, and you know, some people have traveled some distance to be here. And I thank you for that. Also thank the Foundation for the opportunity to have had this period of study, the support and the encouragement I've had from the staff and from my colleagues, the other fellows here at the center this semester. As Rob indicated to you, I come to you and I come to this subject not as a historian or an anthropologist, but as a psychologist and an educator. I must tell you that I have pursued
these various topics that Rob was mentioning, because of an interest that originated with the rights of people who are mentally retarded. And putting myself in the role of as an advocate for people in that group, and gradually then that leading me to want to tell some of the stories of people who were classified as mentally retarded but weren't. That leading me further and causing me to be more and more interested in this whole eugenics movement that caused such pain earlier in this century in Virginia, throughout our country, and around the world. And I'd like to mention just a couple of things about this previous work to preface my remarks on the current work. I, some years ago, became interested in the mythical story of the Kallikak family, which was a story written by Henry Goddard, a psychologist, published in 1912. And it was supposed to have been, according to Goddard, this natural experiment in the hereditary nature of defectiveness or mental deficiency. The story of the Kallikaks, two families branching off from the same man, one an illegitimate branch with a supposedly feeble-minded woman, and the other an upstanding branch of the family with his wife, as Goddard described her, an upstanding Quaker woman. And then this story unfolding generation after generation, the bad Kallikaks always being bad, the good Kallikaks always being just wonderful, the bad Kallikaks being criminals and feeble-minded people and such, and the good Kallikaks being successes and good citizens. Because of being intrigued with the story, I tried several years ago to crack the code. Kallikak was a pseudonym. I was able to go back and find the real name and revisit the stories of these people that Goddard had told, and was able to find that the story wasn't true, and all the good Kallikaks weren't good, and all the bad weren't bad. And that this myth that had been used as a rationale for institutionalizing people was a falsehood. More recently, in studying Carrie Buck, the young woman from Charlottesville, who at the age of 17 was institutionalized at the Lynchburg Colony because of so-called feeble-mindedness, been used as a test case all the way to the Supreme Court level for the constitutionality of Virginia's law, which said that the state could sterilize a person against their will if they were proven to be defective. Finding that Carrie wasn't feeble-minded, she was simply poor and alone and defenseless. She became the pawn for that story. And by the way, I was going to use some transparency today. I want you to know I've got them right here. But we decided that having a machine between me and you would complicate things. And so I want to use a few phrases to kind of serve as an outline for you to have something to hang on to. And so from this interest I've had in eugenics, I'd like to look at another sort of subtopic that I entitled Otto Hoffman, Nuremberg and Virginia, the eugenic connection. The Nazis passed their own sterilization law in 1933. It was modeled on Virginia's that had been tested with Carrie Buck at the Supreme, through the Supreme Court level. As a matter of fact, the person from the Eugenics Record Office on Long Island, who had really been the author of Virginia's law, a man named Harry Laughlin, was recognized by the University of Heidelberg in 1936 for his groundbreaking work in eugenics and was given an honorary doctorate there. There were close ties between the eugenicists in America and those in Germany. And whereas 8,000 people were eventually sterilized in Virginia through our law, and 50,000 people were sterilized around the country, 2 million people were sterilized in Germany. They took our law and used it more more energetically, more widely. As I was looking at the court record of Otto Hoffman, who was tried at Nuremberg, and it was charged with crimes of forced sterilization of Jews in Eastern Europe, of forced abortions in cases of mixed marriages of Jews and Aryans, of the dissolution of marriages, mixed marriages, came across an interesting bit of defense used in Hoffman's case. His defense attorney used these words in defending Hoffman for having sterilized and aborted and destroyed marriages. He said, since 1907, sterilization laws have been passed in 29 states of the United States of America. Those affected by the law were primarily criminals, feeble-minded, insane, epileptics, alcoholic, and narcotic addicts, as well as prostitutes. Although almost all states try to carry out sterilization on a voluntary basis, the courts have more than once ordered compulsory sterilizations. In a judgment of the Supreme Court in 1927, it says, among other things, it is better for everybody if society, instead of waiting until it has to execute degenerate offspring or leave them to starve because of their feeble-mindedness, can prevent obviously inferior individuals from propagating their own kind. The principle justifying compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover the severing of fallopian tubes. By the way, those last words are a direct quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes' majority opinion in the Supreme Court decision. The defense goes on, however, with Hoffman's case, and says the United States also provides an excellent example for the racial legislation of the world in another respect. Although it is clearly established in the Declaration of Independence that everyone born in the United States is a citizen of the United States and so acquires all the rights which an American citizen can acquire, impassable lines are drawn between the individual races, especially in the southern states. Marriages between colored persons and whites are forbidden in no less than 30 of the federal states. Marriages contracted in spite of this ban are declared invalid. These prohibit marriage between white people and people from a number of different racially designated groups, including Negroes, Indians, Mulattoes, and Mongolians. And so we had set the precedent for a number of the things that happened in Nazi Germany. I'd like to ask you to go back to 1922 with me, and I want to introduce some characters to you. Ernest Cox was an insurance salesman in Richmond, but an avocation of his was racism. He wrote a book entitled White America. In that book, he advocated solving the race problem in America by sending people, black people, back to Africa, to repatriating black people to Africa. He continued with this suggestion and this proposed solution well into the 70s. It was a lifetime commitment for Ernest Cox. Ernest Cox, however, might not have been noticed much or made much of a difference, except for a friend, an ally, a man by the name of John Powell. John Powell was from a prestigious Virginia family. He was an FFV. He was an internationally recognized composer and musician. And John Powell and Ernest Cox in 1922 formed the Anglo-Saxon Clubs of America, the first chapter being in Richmond. And their express purpose was to influence legislation, to influence social policy. It's a little different than the KKK. The Anglo-Saxon Clubs of America was composed of gentlemen who intended to do their work through political and powerful social channels. And let me read to you a couple of the goals of the organization. The fundamental purpose of the organization is the preservation and maintenance of Anglo-Saxon ideals and civilization in America. This purpose is to be accomplished in three ways. The first, by the strengthening of Anglo-Saxon instincts, traditions, and principles among representatives of our original American stock. Second, by intelligent selection and exclusion of immigrants. And third, by fundamental and final solutions of our racial problems. That final solution has an ominous ring to it, doesn't it? Well, the Anglo-Saxon clubs of America, or at least the Richmond chapter, was very effective in lobbying with the state legislature. And among the things that they publicly announced that they would be lobbying for are, one, there should be instituted immediately a system of registration and birth certificates showing the racial composition, white, black, brown, yellow, red, of every resident of the state. No marriage license shall be granted save upon the presentation and attestation under oath of both parties of said registration or birth certificates. Whites, third, white persons may only marry whites. Fourth, for the purposes of legislation, the term white person shall apply only to individuals who have no trace whatsoever of any blood other than Caucasian. The club was successful, and in 1924, the legislature of Virginia enacted the Race Integrity Act. The Race Integrity Act created two races in Virginia, and only two. And those two races were white and colored. And if you were not white, you were to be designated as colored, and we'll see to what extent and how that was interpreted in a few minutes. Among the things that it did was legislate Native American people out of existence in Virginia. When the law was actually passed in the legislature, whereas the Anglo-Saxon club had said no trace whatsoever of any blood other than white, it's the only way you can be white, they did make one exception. And that is, they said, if you had no more than 1/16 American Indian blood, then you could be classified as white. Apparently, this was a concession to those first families of Virginia that for generations had boasted of a connection to Pocahontas and other Indian nobles. In 1926, someone proposed that the ratio be brought to 1/32nd. Right, if you had no more than 1/32nd, then you could be white, but no. But that included some of the FFB people, so that never got through. But the 1/16th clause stayed in. I now need to introduce another character. His name was Walter Plecker. And I'd like to discuss with you Walter Plecker, vital statistics, and what he sometimes referred to as the color line. Walter Plecker was a physician. He was born and he grew up in Augusta County. After studying medicine, he worked in Alabama for a while. He then worked in Hampton. And then through some political connections, he was appointed as the first registrar of vital statistics in Virginia. Walter Plecker was also a member of the Anglo-Saxon Clubs of America, one of the charter members, I might add. He was a friend and ally of John Powell's. Plecker used the Race Integrity Act and his office for racial assaults of all kinds. Let me give you an example. Now, this is an official letter from the Bureau of Vital Statistics. This one going to a woman in Lynchburg, as a matter of fact. Plecker had received a tip from someone in Lynchburg about this woman and her baby. And he wrote to her as follows: "Madam, dear madam, we have a report of the birth of your child on July 30th, 1923, signed by," and the name of a midwife there. She says that you are white and that the father of the child is white. We have a correction to this certificate, which has been sent to us, in which they say that the father of this child is a Negro. This is to give you warning that this is a mulatto child, and you cannot pass it off as white. A new law passed by the last legislature says that if a child has one drop of Negro blood, it cannot be counted as white. You will have to do something about this matter and see that this child is not allowed to mix with white children. It cannot go to white schools. It can never marry a white person in Virginia. It is an awful thing. Plecker issued these kinds of decrees with unsubstantiated information on a regular basis. Let me give you an example of his issuing a decree based on a vote taken in a community. The superintendent of a school system wrote to Plecker and said, some people in the community question the racial origins of a certain group. Plecker replies, this is the first time that our attention has been called to this family, and we have no information in regard to them. We have, however, made a photostatic copy of the petition. This is the 15 people had signed, which we will preserve in our files as evidence, being the opinion of 15 citizens of that county, and upon that information, we will designate any of these children found in our records as colored, regardless of the statement of the attendant who reported these births. So he took the 15 votes, went back to records, and changed them. The suggestion, he goes on, which we would make is that if these children are Negroid in appearance, and especially if one of the parents is known to be colored, they'd be classified as colored and excluded from the white schools. And he goes on to talk about marriage, and that this family will now be watched, be followed. On the basis of 15 votes, a family that Plecker had never seen, he had no other documentation, that's the way he operated. He got into all sorts of areas of people's lives. Riverview Cemetery is here in Charlottesville. At one point he wrote to the superintendent of the cemetery. He had noticed on a death certificate, or in information related to this death, that the person was being buried in Riverview. And he wrote to the superintendent saying, this person is colored, according to our records. Should you have buried him in your cemetery? Plecker even says, I don't know what the law is, but you might want to think about this. Followed up with several letters saying, how is it going to look if these people come to visit the grave, and they are people of color? He hounded superintendents of cemeteries. As we'll see, he hounded census takers, even the Selective Service Board, in making sure that people who he decided were people of color should be separated and isolated out. Now, this idea of there only being two races of people in Virginia, white and colored, let's look at how he responded to some questions he would receive from local registrars. In writing to one of them in 1935, he said, in reply to your inquiry as to the racial classification of a native Filipino, I beg to advise you that they, as well as Asiatics, including Chinese, Japanese, natives of India, and so forth, are classed as colored and included with the colored in compiling the statistics. Under the law of Virginia, Filipinos and other Asiatics are not permitted to marry white people. The child will be classed as colored. The law may have said it was a Race Integrity Act, but it was only concerned with perceived integrity of one race. Plecker even made long-distance diagnoses of people according to their mental ability and made recommendations. Here's a letter he sent to a locality in Virginia. As to deciding the point of race, you and the sheriff and any other intelligent citizen of your community are as capable of judging from the appearance of the child as the most learned scientist. There's absolutely no blood or other test to determine that question. only the appearance of the children and the habits of the mother. The proper thing to do, talking about the mother of these children, without loss of time, is to place this woman in the state colony and have her sterilized. Plecker was particularly concerned and has been particularly vehement in his assault on Virginia's Indian people. I think he was troubled by them so much because they appeared to him to violate the neat classification which he wished to have of white and colored. That there were people in the state who energetically and persistently clung to their Indian identity. And I think it troubled him. And he looked for every way he could to eliminate that nuisance and to reestablish this clean separation of the races. Upon being asked about the Indians in Virginia, at one point, he said, you know, we're in possession of old records that prove that these people are all just colored people. We've got old records that show that those are now showing up saying they're Indians, that back before the Civil War, in the census, they were shown as colored. That other records showed them as colored. And he used that as his strongest arguing point. And Plecker repeatedly told people, there is no Indian in Virginia. There are no Indians in this state. And my records prove that. And he focused on the Pamunkeys. He focused on the Chickahominy. He focused on the Monacan people of Amherst County and gave them no rest. He gave them no rest when they attempted to have their children designated as Indian on birth certificates. He gave them no rest when they attempted to have their racial designation indicated in marriage licenses or other records. But what is obvious from the records that are here, and by the way, Plecker, I think because he was proud of his efforts and his persistence, Plecker started in 1924, making carbon copies of all his correspondence to people, like the things I've been reading to here, to people relating to race, relating to Indians in Virginia, made carbon copies of everything he wrote and sent them to John Powell. So John Powell put these away in a file. When John Powell died, his papers came to the University of Virginia, and through him, we have a pretty complete record of Plecker's activities over a more than 20-year period when it comes to race, and particularly when it comes to Virginia's Indians. What I had not seen before, starting to look at those papers and study, and looking at some of the case law, is that the Race Integrity Act was challenged almost as soon as it was passed. And the first challenges that came to that Race Integrity Act occurred in Rockbridge County. The cases were heard by Judge Henry Holt. The first challenge came from a member of that group that we now know are the Monacan group. And the woman who wished to marry a man who was classified as white was denied a marriage license. But in denying that, Henry Holt said, the judge said, I'm very uncomfortable with this because this puts the burden of proof upon the person whose race is being questioned. And how do you ever prove? And he made the statement, he said, in my own case, probably half the people who fought at the Battle of Hastings are my ancestors. He said, if you go back 25 generations, you have 32 million grandparents. How are you going to prove they're all pure? how do you do that? And so he expressed this discomfort, even though he denied the license. In the second challenge, again from this Monacan group, the people had done their homework. Plecker was aware that they were spending a lot of time in the courthouse. He got nervous about it. There's letters indicating. He told the local registrar, watch what they're doing. Let me know what they're doing. Obviously, they prepared themselves well. And in the second challenge, Holt found for the woman. Plecker and Powell was, don't appeal it. It appears to be working outside of Holt's district. Carry on. And for 25 years, Plecker carried on with this very shaky law that should have been tested, and had the Indian people of Virginia had the advocate and the resources to have done it, I'm convinced could have overturned it. It wouldn't have withstood that kind of test. But they didn't have those resources with which to fight. Plecker went beyond writing to people and challenging them and intimidating them. He got into the practice of changing records there at the Bureau of Vital Statistics on his own without informing people. And he'd come across a record that designated Indian, and he'd just scratch it out and put colored. This legacy lived on for a long time. You know, the miscegenation law was overturned in the early 1963, that law was found to be unconstitutional in the Loving case. 2 weeks ago, in a meeting with the Monacan people in Amherst, several of us attended, Jeff Hammond was there. The mother of a 17-year-old boy, as we were talking about this thing, she said, you know, it didn't stop. It didn't stop in the 40s, it didn't stop in the 60s. She explained that in the early 70s, she was in the hospital giving birth to this 17-year-old. And she designated on the form that on his birth certificate, he should be shown as an Indian child. And she was told, we cannot do that. We cannot use that designation in Virginia. She was told that by the medical staff. Good, and fortunately for her, she said, we'll see about that. And she got legal help. But what happened, you see, Plecker sent out hit lists. Not only to local registrars, but to hospitals and to physicians. And these hit lists would contain the names of people in your county, your city. And he said, if you see any of these names coming through the hospital or coming to you for treatment or applying for marriage license, these are not to be allowed, these people are not to be allowed to be Indians. And Plecker had died, and the law had been found unconstitutional, but hospitals and other institutions continued for a long time to act on that legacy, as unbelievable as that may be. Next topic I want to explore with you for a bit. I entitled Human Beings as Mongrels, a Eugenic Tragedy. When I was studying the sterilization of Carrie Buck, I studied the work of a field researcher from the Eugenics Record Office who had been assigned, who came down to study Carrie Buck's background and testify in court that she was from defective stock. His name was Arthur Estabrook. And that was in 1924. But Estabrook had already been to the Amherst-Lynchburg area. Estabrook had, a bit earlier, and actually continuing on, come to Amherst County to collaborate with a sociology professor at Sweetbriar by the name of Ivan McDougall. And what they did was, they went and did field research on the Indian people of Amherst. And the people there responded by opening their homes to them, by answering their questions, by giving them information about their parents and grandparents. Esther Brooke was a eugenic enthusiast. I don't know too much about McDougall. He moved on to Goucher College shortly after that and taught sociology. But Esther Brooke was a professional eugenicist. They took the data that these people had given to them, and they wrote a book about the ills of race mixing, about how it led to degeneracy, and they entitled that book Mongrel Virginians. When I first saw a copy of Mongrel Virginia, I can't describe to you the experience of it. The title is enough. But they began to look at that. And of course, they were using pseudonyms for the people and for the places. And instead of Amherst County, they were calling it Abb County. Well, you read a couple of pages and you know exactly what, you know, any familiarity with the region, you know what they're talking about. It is page after page of indictment, eugenic indictment of the people. Also, in that book was a copy of, when it was eventually published in 26, was a copy of the Race Integrity Act of 1924. And Esther Brooke and McDougall closed their book by saying, you know, if this law is enforced, it will in fact save the integrity of the race, the white race, in Virginia. Well, as enthusiastic as Esther Brooke was, to the extent that that certainly biased his view of what he saw in the Indian people there, I guess Plecker was even a little too much for Esther Brooke. And for Esther Brooke's boss, Charles Davenport, who was the director of the Eugenics Record Office on Long Island, which was funded by the Carnegie Institution, Plecker wanted to have the code for Mongrel Virginians. He wanted to break through the pseudonyms and get the real names. And he wrote to Dr. Davenport saying, I'm sorry, Esther Brooke, in talking to Dr. Davenport about Plecker's plea, give me the code, give me this, or give me a copy of the manuscript before it's published. And he said, my dear Dr. Davenport, Dr. W.A. Plecker's offer to make copies of the manuscript is due to the fact that he himself desires a copy to use, not only in checking his own records, but to use in the various cases now appearing in Virginia in the courts, where some of these people are filing suits to compel the county clerks to issue them registration with the Indian on it. Permitting him to have access to these names and data would involve us in a great deal of trouble, and I fear publicity that would come back to hurt us. That is my feeling on the matter. Plecker tried and tried. He wrote to Esther Brooke. He wrote to Davenport again and again saying, I want the code. I need the names. Finally, on a copy of a letter that I found at the Library of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, where they have the Davenport papers, there's a copy of Plecker's last letter requesting the code, requesting information, and penciled in is no! Exclamation point. Plecker never got it. Plecker, however, claimed to have the data in many situations. He said, we know who these people are, and here's the data we have. He was faking. Russell Booker, director of vital statistics in Virginia, in talking about what Plecker did, he said, you know, in the mid-19th century, state records for births, marriages, and deaths were divided into two categories, white and colored. The colored category was divided into free and slave. In the 1920s, when Plecker and his friends got the Racial Integrity Act passed, colored had been defined as Negro. Booker said Indians who had been considered colored were now considered black. And records that Plecker referred to, as I've got proof, were due to the fact that color was used for Indian. Color, at that point, in 1853, was used in that way, and was no proof of anything, certainly no proof of a lack of Indian heritage. Booker refers to what Plecker did as documentary genocide, that the Indians of Virginia were killed off through documentation. And it came close to happening. I'd like to share with you a challenge that was issued to Plecker. In 1942, there were some Indian people in Amherst who asked that they have copies of their birth certificates without any notation on the back. What Plecker had gotten into the habit of doing, if there was Indian on a birth certificate or marriage record, he would issue the license, but on the back he would write, we do not accept this designation, and this person is considered to be colored. We do not accept the Indian designation in Virginia. And he'd have that in there. Well, a couple of Indian people in Amherst asked for a certificate, and they asked that no notation be put on the back. Plecker issued the certificates with notations on the back. They went back through a lawyer who said to Plecker, you have no right to do this. They hired a powerful attorney in Richmond by the name of Tucker, who said to Plecker, I find nowhere in the law any provision which authorizes the registrar to constitute himself the judge or jury for the purpose of determining the race of a child born and authorizing him to alter the records as filed in your office, in the office of local registrars. I desire and demand a correct copy of the record in your office as it there appears, without comment from you, and without additions or subtractions. And I hereby notify you that unless I obtain a prompt compliance with your official duties as prescribed by law, I shall apply to a proper court for mandamus to compel you to perform your duty. Plecker wrote to William Sandage, who was the local registrar in Amherst, and he said, surely on this record there's something that will back me up. I can't imagine what Plecker must have felt when Sandage wrote back to him, and he said, the only record we have, I have today referred to marriage register number 4 and find that the classification as to race or color is plainly stated as Indian where the record of this marriage is entered. Now, with a legal challenge, Plecker found that he had no leg to stand on. He issued the license with this statement to the lawyer, as you point out, and as the Attorney General advises, the law does not permit us to give the truth on the certificates, but seems to compel me as state registrar to certify what I know absolutely to be false. The next day he wrote to John Powell and listened to these words. He tells Powell, we've had a challenge here, we've got a problem, and listen to what he admits. In reality, I have been doing a good deal of bluffing, knowing all the while that it could not be legally sustained. This is the first time my hand has been absolutely called. 20 years of bluffing. I might add bullying and intimidating, and intervening in the most intimate areas of people's lives, and there was no legal basis for it. I'm going to make a few more comments and then try to answer any questions there might be. In a letter to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs in 1943, responding to a complaint that had been made to the commissioner about Plecker's activities, about his harassment of Indian people in Virginia. Plecker says, "We would be delighted to have you or your representative visit our office and examine the mass of original information pedigree charts showing the racial origins of mixed breeds trying to pass as Indian. Our own index birth and marriage records showing race reach back to 1853. Such a study has probably never been made before. Your staff member is probably correct in his surmise that Hitler's genealogical study of the Jews is not more complete." I'd like to end with on a personal note. My intent is to tell this story, which I think is a story that very much needs to be told, to try and to tell it fairly. I think it speaks for itself. I think it will tell itself in terms of the tragedy. And I think it needs to be told, you know, the Jewish people, and looking at the Holocaust, has said time and time again, never again. Well, I think this is another part of the story that we need to know and commit ourselves that never could this sort of thing happen again. Story from childhood. I remember little boy I played with when I was in elementary school. And it didn't mean much to me then when it happened. But one day, in sort of hushed tones, he told me, he said, "You know, I'm part Indian. But Martha says we can't talk about it." There are a lot of people who are forced to deny part of their heritage because of the climate that Walter Plecker represents. I contrast that to an experience I had this fall. My children and I attend a fall bazaar every year. It's put on by the Monacan people. It's a good time, and there's good food. And my children got to the point where they kind of think, you know, first weekend in October, we're going to the festival. When we were there this year, there was a woman at a special display who'd done a new genealogy of one aspect, one family in the Monacan group. And my wife was talking with her, and they were tracing back, and my wife found some names that were very familiar to her, as a matter of fact, some names from her own family background. And they started comparing notes and found that way back through marriage and distant connection, that there was this connection between her family and some of the Monacan people. Coming back, my wife was explaining that to our children, who were 11 and 9 and 7. And they were just bouncing up and down with excitement. Are we related to the Indian people? And we told, you know, as much as I tried to tell them, well, it's distant and it's their marriage, they were so excited and felt a sense of pride. In that sense, they made me proud. It made me feel that perhaps we're moving in the right direction. To those of you here who represent tribal groups in Virginia, let me say in a way of dedication that I hope that, that through many efforts that are being made now, you will find justice and peace for yourselves and for your children, and also in some ways for your ancestors. Thank you, and I'll try to answer questions. The whole eugenic thing it attracted true believers who felt, that the backbone of America, the racial stock of America, was being attacked in one way or another. And there were those who focused on immigrants, right? And Henry Goddard, who went to Ellis Island and tested people going off the boat with IQ tests, people who spoke little English and survived the passage over, and then he's asking, how far is it from New York to Chicago? And then he classifies them as morons, right? Others who focused on what someone has called the white trash studies, right? And who focused on people like Kerry Buck and poor white people and saw them as a defective class of people. And I think Plecker, the expression of that eugenic zeal got focused on Indian people, and he resented their existence because it complicated his view of the world, and he wanted them to be gone. Fortunately for us, it didn't work. A lot of people were hurt, but ultimately it didn't work.
I'd like to comment on your letter from the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. I worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, and when I first came here in 1961, I heard that story about this communication that went back and forth. And apparently, when the Bureau came back from Chicago, Illinois to Washington, a number of its Indian employees moved into Alexandria and Arlington, and a woman had had a child there, a full-blood Kiowa woman. She had a child, and when the child was 5 years old, she had to get his birth record to enter it in school. And that's when she found the birth record had colored on it for her. And she contacted the biostatistics people, and they said, no, any child born in Virginia to an Indian is colored. And that's what led to this correspondence there. And that also might have led to the policy of the Bureau that we don't take race on birth records as for documentation. We use a birth record for the date of birth or death and for the parents of the individual.
Thank you.
I very much enjoyed your talk. I was wondering, though, because you do mention the connection between Native Americans and Indians and African Americans from a very early period and being classified similarly. For example, as early as the first laws in the 1660s regarding race, for example, and classification of blacks and slaves, also lumped together in some of the legislation, Indian peoples and black peoples, and also the census records starting in 1790 all the way through the 1800s, they also do so. Was there something else happening in Virginia in the 1920s that made it so, this kind of connection that had always been there, made it so stringently enforced? I mean, was there also at the same time an attempt to, for example, control black people who were also non-white people from becoming more politically powerful, socially powerful, or whatever, that could help to also explain the development of the Anglo-Saxon clubs? And
yeah, thank you. And there's another aspect of this story that in the manuscript I'm preparing I will tell more fully. And that's John Powell was much more involved and enthusiastic in terms of the control of black people, and became involved, for example, in controversies at Hampton Institute. There was something called the Massenburg Bill, which eventually passed, which called for the separation of races at all public events. And that had come as a result of white people being invited, courteously invited, to events at Hampton Institute, concerts and so forth, and then complaining because they were sitting too close to black people. And then Hampton being accused of, they used the word social equality was a curse. Hampton being accused of advocating social equality, Powell was very much involved in that. There's an interesting story of his involvement with Marcus Garvey. He saw Garvey as a person that he could link up with and accomplish his goals, and there were a lot of attempts, and there's documentation in the collection here, a lot of attempts to manipulate Garvey Amy Garvey spoke at a meeting of the Richmond chapter of the Anglo-Saxon Clubs. So yes, that was going on as well. And it really was an attempt at control of non-white people. Thank you.
Yeah, on your notion of documented genocide, I wonder if you come across anything regarding the views of Indians during the 1920s. For example, were the views presented in the textbooks given to Virginia high school and grammar school students? Was there an attempt on the one hand to legislate Indians out of existence in the present? Did they try to rewrite the past? I mean, what was the depiction of the immediate past? Was it noble? Were they important part of a story, the founding of Virginia? What's Virginia going to do with its history at the same time as trying to control its present?
It's a great question. I don't know, Mitchell. Need to go back and look. It'd be interesting to see what impact that had on the school text. I would suspect if Pleckert had his way, there'd be no contemporary history of Indians, because he said they weren't here anymore. And Pleckert would make, they were here, but now they're gone. And so there might have been people who wanted to tell stories of those noble people long ago, but who would have denied their existence in the 20th century.
How did you respond to anthropologists who were studying Virginia Indians like Frank Speck, who was publishing and saying yes and describing cultures and people?
Yeah. When those people showed up in Plecker's office, and some of them did, they got lectured to. And in his correspondence, he felt that they were being duped. Another sad part of the thing, though, is that after Mongrel Virginians were published, and after this continuing assault, a lot of Native American people in Virginia then didn't want to talk with anybody. I mean, even the people who could have helped them tell their legitimate story, they were scared, and I understand that.
I just wanted to make a statement and then ask a question. Ask a question first. Did you run across any love letters?
Yes.
There's a story that goes among the Indian people that he wanted the affection of an Indian woman and she turned him down, and so he decided he was going to make an assault on the Indian people and get rid of them once and for all. And this has just been passed down. I've never seen it printed, but it's been passed down, I know, from my grandparents. When they were in the old age, they passed to my father, passed on down. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. I doubt it.
Well, I didn't. I haven't found any documentation that indicates that.
And the other thing was just a statement that one of the Indian women was a licensed midwife, and we had access to a letter that was written by Dr. Blackwood, saying that if she didn't stop putting that Indian designation on, that he was going to revoke her license and send her to prison.
Yes.
And so she stopped practicing the trade, too.
Sad. Yeah, there were often threats of penitentiary terms. I think the next question was here.
I wanted to ask you if you had looked at the extent to which Walter Pucker's legacy was still a problem today. I hear bits and pieces from different people in the tribes, and I know that Russell Booker is working with the Monica people to have their birth certificates changed, but I just wondered if there might not be a more systematic attempt to try and identify some of the institutions that are still involved in this and get them to correct it, as opposed to approaching it on a case-by-case basis.
Good. I don't know of any, but obviously there's a crying need for systematic examination of what was done with records. And golly, I think if something could, if somehow such a project could be undertaken, it'd be a wonderful thing. There's a crying need for education of all sorts in communities of both people who might have been affected by Plecker's assault, and also people who don't understand. I think most of the population of this state has no idea what was done to our Indian people.
And what it really means.
Yes, yes. And there are people who still use some of the old terms for Indian people, insulting terms, and apparently don't know. You know, in the Lynchburg area, there are people who will still use the term issue, which is a racial slur. And so there's this great need for systematic examination, for education in our communities.
Obviously, anti-Semitism is a little harder to get to in some ways because of the clear-cut racial designation. And just as obviously, the Anglo-Saxon clubs must have been part of their program as well. I just don't know how that figured in and how it may or may not have influenced Plecker, or if he did anything at all along lines to.